Hello?
Who's this?
Who are you trying to reach?
Wait, I was just wondering what you're doing tonight.
Just getting ready to listen to a podcast.
Ooh, you like podcasts? What's your favorite podcast?
Oh, just Percolated Media's Three Men in a Retrospective podcast where they look at various franchises one film at a time.
Really? Is that the one with Garrett, Adam, and Matt?
Yeah, this next month and a half, they'll be looking at the Scream series, where two of them haven't watched past the fourth film of the series.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
Because I want to know who I'm looking at.
Scream 2022. This was released January 14th, 2022. Budget on this was $24 million. Box office worldwide was $138.9 million. What a profit. And this is directed by Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillette. Three things right off the bat. A, I am not calling two grown men radio silence. I don't care what anybody says. B, I had no idea that Wednesday Addams was in this fucking franchise. And C, I had no idea a future Oscar winner was Ghostface. I was really taken aback by this film. Now, in the lead up to this, Matt, what were you expecting going into Scream 2022?
My expectations were I hope to be entertained at the bare minimum, but I will say compared to four, I was more excited for this, not just because of the time frame. I think we were kind of overdue for a new Scream, although we'll talk about there were some pieces in the franchise that did not go to theaters in between four and this one that are worth discussing. But I was also curious to see how this would look with a new voice at the helm. You know, Wes Craven unfortunately passed away in between movies. And going into this movie, I was a big fan of the directors they chose to take the reins on this. Before we got the marketing and stuff, just when they announced who was behind this and they were going to make a new one, I thought it was actually overdue and I was pretty excited.
Now, Adam, what were you expecting? I mean, this comes out 2022. You hadn't seen the other one, so you just kind of let this kind of fly by, right?
Yeah, I wasn't interested only because, like, look, I knew there was a TV series. I didn't bother with that. And this just felt at that time, look, we were just coming out of some bad stuff country-wise, back into some bad stuff country-wise. So I don't know. It wasn't enough to get me up and going because it felt like it had run its course at that point, especially being that they had, what, three or four seasons of a TV. The TV series had been rebooted.
Yeah, we'll get to the TV series. I'll get to that here in a bit. Go ahead.
So to get me in theaters, I wasn't interested, though. I think if I would have known who wrote and directed it, it might have spurred me a little more because I do like what these guys have done before. But I gotta say, not being as savvy as the Utes out there nowadays, I had no idea what radio silence was until I Googled it. So reading trivia confused the piss out of me for this movie.
Yeah, you got the writer of such great things as The Amazing Spider-Man. That should have made you stoked.
Yes, but they directed one of my favorite kitschy movies with Ready or Not.
That was the thing. And I remember, Matt, when we did that series at the old place, you were really excited for this. You had mentioned that you would really like Ready or Not. You guys had both recommended me see that movie, which I did. But when the movie was released, you know what it was? We were a brand new site at that time, and I knew we were going to cover this eventually. So I just kind of put it off on the back burner, and I was like, it's been 11 years. I know we're going to cover it. I'm just not going to watch it. And I put it off, and two movies later, here we are. Now, Adam, you mentioned the TV series. Let me get into that real quick. So, Scream 4 is released, and Williamson did say at that time, and Craven, they both said, we have ideas for two other ones if this one does well. Guess what? As we mentioned last week, Scream 4 did not do as well as expected. All those plans were kind of put on the back burner. 2015, Wes Craven, as Matt mentioned, unfortunately passes away. 2017, we all know what happened with Harvey Weinstein and his company. So everything was kind of dissipated. Yet in between all that, Kevin Williamson did write the pilot of a TV show that this is what I do for our listeners. Now, I paid $50 on YouTube to watch the entire TV series. It ran three seasons. The first two seasons did not use the mask as advertised. I mean, it literally just used the Scream name is what I took it as. And Craven was all for this. Craven was actually listed as a producer on the first season. He did say they're taking it in a new direction, and I'm in all support of it. And then towards the end of that first season, he was coming out saying, you know, maybe we should have gone back to those tropes that we did so well in that Scream series. The second season, they play with the same characters, another big whodunit. And they did have like a character who represented Randy. You know, you had all the representations in that TV series. And by the third season, they went right back to Randy Jackson as the voice. They went right back to the original costume, and Queen Latifah, of all people, was the producer of the third season of Scream, the TV series. Now, overall, I think it's okay. I think they used the IP okay, but it did seem like something just to keep the IP alive. Matt, did you watch that TV series?
No, I had no interest, largely because it was on MTV, of all channels. And I always confused it, ironically, with a show that you worked on, Scream Queens.
Oh, yeah.
Which ran pretty close to at least one of the seasons, from what I can remember, that neither of which particularly piqued my interest. I saw the pilot for Scream Queens and said, I don't think this will be for me. But to your point, I do think the multiple seasons indicated to me that they were just doing it in the same way that people made Fantastic Four movies to keep the rights. It's like, hey, we're doing this out of contractual obligation, but also just to keep the franchise in people's minds, because to your previous statement, given Scream 4's lack of returns from a box office standpoint compared to what they wanted, there was a certain justification to say, hey, maybe this isn't the draw to the masses that we thought it would be.
All right. Well, the series runs doesn't really make that much of a dent, but around the time of 2018, 2019, there were rumblings that Scream was going to come back as a movie. And then you get these guys, Ready or Not comes out, and these guys were reported to be huge fans of the original series, huge fans of Wes Craven, and they started putting this together with their third, a guy by the name of Guy Busick, and James Vanderbilt, who, as I mentioned, he wrote the Amazing Spider-Man film, but he also did Zodiac, so he has a little bit of a hit-and-miss record.
Well, he seems like a writer for hire, because he does, I mean, this is the guy who started with Darkness Falls, of all things, which is a piece of crap.
Oof.
But yeah, his track record is very spotty, but he's also one of those writers where he's more often than not listed as a co-writer on multiple things. I don't think there's been a lot of movies where he's been the sole screenwriter, because even his early stuff like The Rundown, he was a co-writer. Zodiac, I'm pretty sure he's solely listed, but given Fincher's OCD level of completionism, I'm pretty sure he gave that thing quite a few passovers. And his involvement, I was just like, it's whatever. It's not, I said, at least it's not Aaron Kruger. That was my thought. But I was also a fan of these guys from VHS. I thought their segment was the best one by far. And an anthology that I thought largely wasn't great, like I thought the Ty West one was horrendous, I thought theirs was far and away the best.
Ty West, that was the one where they were in the woods, right? That was the Ty West one?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember that not being good either. Yeah, so they start working on this, and then you have the uphill battle of getting the cast together. Now, they got their cast, Melissa Barrera, Jenna Ortega. They weren't really big names at this time. Dennis Quaid's son, Jack Quaid. Cuba Gooding's son, who I had no idea was in this. They got them pretty quick. And then this so reminded me of Star Wars and The Force Awakens, because they got to get the legacy characters. And
they should have called this movie in the marketing, The Scream Awakens.
I thought of that title, and I thought about maybe doing it as tongue-in-cheek to begin this, because that's the first thing I thought of, Matt. I don't think there was any question that Courtney Cox and David Arquette were going to come back. They've always talked high of this franchise, and no matter what happened in their personal lives, as I mentioned in Scream 4, they always handled themselves pretty professionally on these sets, and they genuinely liked being in these films. But as always, the big question, could they get Neve Campbell? Neve Campbell was adamant, saying, no, I'm not going to be a part of this. Wes isn't around to maybe give his approval, and he was the one I trusted along with Kevin Williamson. If they're not around, then I don't want to do it. Then these guys put together a nice letter to her, basically saying how much they love Wes Craven, and they swear they're not going to do anything to tarnish his legacy. In fact, if anything, it is going to pay tribute to it. It won her over. I think a few zeros on that contract won her over as well, but here she was. She signed on. And we have our cast. Now, Adam, as somebody who, like me, you hadn't seen this coming in, Neve Campbell's coming back. Did that kind of pique your interest a little bit?
I don't think you reboot this without her. if you did it with just Gale and Dewey, I think you end up looking like a spinoff. You can pay your $7, $10 million and you're going to get 15 to 20 just in the extra box office that you would lose if she wasn't. What I think the obvious move that they were trying to move past, those original three, original four or five, you can't do it without Neve Campbell. It would have been a fool's errand. Whatever Paramount had to pony up at the time was a smart deal.
I feel the opposite. My rationale was, if you're rebooting this, I would have completely made it independent, not independent in the sense that it's separate from continuity, but I would have left the legacy characters behind and just focused on an entirely new cast. That would have been my approach, largely because I wanted to distance this. And we talked about Star Wars, and this won't be the only time we mentioned Star Wars comparisons in this particular film. I thought it was kind of a fool's errand to bring them all back because of how, through both planning and bad luck, that Star Wars kind of, it's still contestably debated whether that was done well. And also, Halloween had just done this again. I mean, they had done it before with H2O, saying, oh, the other movies didn't really happen. This is a direct sequel. They got Jamie Lee Curtis back and whatnot, mixing it with a new cast. We'll talk about that franchise down the road, because Woodsboro and Haddonfield might not be that far of a drive compared to some of these other installments based on locations. But I kind of wanted this to be its own thing, especially because you had an entirely new creative team. And Scream 4 kind of brought the band back together already. And the only thing you're adding in this is just some gray hairs and some Botox. And some divorce papers.
Poor David Arquette. Now, another thing I thought about, and it's kind of a reason I kind of stayed away from this as well, is when Scream had come out, it was so fun to have those thoughts that me and Adam had growing up watching those slasher films be regurgitated on screen by somebody who thought like us, right? This new generation isn't concerned with waxing poetic about how great the old slashers were. They're not concerned with Freddy, Jason, maybe a little bit Michael Myers, because as Matt mentioned, that is a series that had come back by this time. So my interest is, could they make this for a new generation? Could they make this for Generation Z? Matt, were you concerned about that at all going in? Like, maybe they were just going to play with the old formula, just with different movies.
Well, my reason for optimism was I thought that this team, unlike a lot of directors who take over these big franchises, not just horror, but Hollywood in general, they're one of the few that have a distinctive voice and style. And I think that was important too. If you're going to reboot this, you got to come at it with both a fresh angle, but also one that reflects the evolution of horror. Look, 2011 and 2022, horror became an entirely different landscape in the same way that things changed from 3 to 4. Although I think this is a much larger, almost a quantum leap in cinematic Darwinism. But I wasn't concerned about that. My concern was just, were people going to care? Because part of the reason with 4 not doing so well was, oh, maybe people just don't care anymore. So I was very, and also coming out of COVID, this was January of 22. So we were still kind of dealing with that, which is why, I mean, this did pretty well, all things considered. I think it was the highest grossing one.
It was.
Which is equally impressive given we were still in the midst of a pandemic. So there was that. And then we'll talk a little bit about the marketing in a couple minutes, but those are my thoughts kind of from a bird's eye view.
This was shot during the pandemic, so there were concerns about that. And it was released right afterwards. Like you mentioned, it did really well. Now, you talk about the marketing. We'll talk about it, but I don't have anything to say about it because I don't remember it at all. All I really remember is saying, look who's back. Guess what? Scream is back. That's all I really remember. Matt, what do you remember about the marketing?
Well, I remember seeing the trailer, which shows the majority of it is the opening, but it also ends with, it's that shot in the third act of Gale and Sydney in front of the house saying, you ready for this? Like, never. So I was like, oh, this is even structured, the trailer. Like, that's like Han and Chewie showing up at the end of the Force Awakens trailer.
Oh my God.
But look, to the movie's credit, it got me curious because I could tell right away, at least bare minimum visually, that it didn't look like a Wes Craven film, which I also appreciated.
Yeah, one thing I will say about these guys is, we had a lot of good things to say about especially the first film. Adam had a lot of really good things to say about the second film. And I had more good things to say about the third film than the two of you. But no matter how much we enjoy them, they are very sloppy films with very scattered tones. So I was kind of, I'm not going to say excited. I was looking forward to seeing how these two were going to handle this because they technically they are much better directors. We talked in Scream 4 that the color grading in that was disastrous. Like I found it to be a really bad grain. So Matt, technically this was going to be a better film no matter what, right?
Well, I would say visually, because I think one of the things I like about them is their visual aesthetic with Ready or Not. I think a lot of the stuff they do with the editing and some of the color grading that they use, I think looks really good. But as far as being a better movie, I thought they also had an uphill climb because, well, I should say actually the opposite, because I felt like after 3 and I thought 4 was a step forward, they had plenty of room for improvement. So it's not like they were, it's not like they were picking up the pieces from like an all-time great sequel. I felt like they had a lot of runway to have the opportunity to do their own thing and not be so slavish. You know, I didn't want this to be, and I was worried about this with the title, like a direct remake of the first one. Mm-hmm. And I also understand it was very intentional them not calling this Scream 5.
All right, Adam, unless you have anything else to add, I want to get right into the plot. Do you have anything to add, Adam? As far as your anticipation, whatnot?
Yeah, I will say, if anything, I thought the trailer did a decent job of conveying that it was a Scream for, not for us, at least not for you and me, but for those that weren't there from the beginning. And it let you know that about cell phones and smart locks and different cast members. So I think The Forced Awakens is about an apt analogy as you can get for the way that they were doing this. And as much as I didn't care, my kids did. So I think that was their goal, and obviously, the box office responded.
Are we looking forward to this, Adam? Are we looking forward to watching this?
By the time we all did this, yes. 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I couldn't care less. Now, watching all the other ones and getting back into it, and look, horror, especially the slasher series, they're sloppy. You're not going in for high cinema. This addresses that. So you kind of know what cheesy corn syrup-filled goodness you're getting. So yeah, after watching the last 4 weeks, I was totally ready to get back into Scream V.
It was also funny timing. Again, I was annoyed they released this in January. Yes. That always rubs me the wrong way.
Dump month.
That's why I didn't have a lot of confidence in it from a critical standpoint going in. But we had a Halloween movie come out in October of 2021, so maybe that's why they did it. I would have been very curious if they released them like at exactly the same time, because that I have plenty of words when we get to Halloween Kills. We get to that eventually.
I think all three of us do. So we start off with Wednesday Addams answering a landline. Right away, I'm asking questions. 2022, who the fuck has a landline?
My first note that I wrote down is, who's got a
phone in 2022? Even Scream 4 didn't, like, I'm already like, what the fuck? So she's talking about how much she loves the Babadook and elevated horror is the way to go and that slashers are now out. She's also texting her friend Amber, more on her later, and we hear the hello that we've heard before, but it's a voice that sounds normal as he's asking Tara to take a message for Christina, who he knows from a group. And so we're following Tara around the house. We have some tracking shots as we hear that she loves scary movies like Christina, and that Christina wonders what her favorite scary movie is. We're hearing about elevated horror, which isn't schlocky, but is full of nakedness. So we're about midway through this conversation. Adam, how do you feel so far going into this?
I feel like they're really trying to update that original. So I think it's almost designed to be provocative towards people like us who maybe, you know, look, I haven't seen The Babadook because the name is The Babadook. And I can't get past that bullshit. But I know people that love it. So that putting in here a discussion about elevated horror versus the slasher genre feels deliberately inserted to cause a fight, and it feels like someone is a little too far with their head up their own ass for me right away.
The Babadook on the recommendation of my brother, of all people, and I thought it was okay.
So I think this was literally addressing the elephant in the room right out of the gate, that horror had become almost a dirty word in the minds of movie fans of this generation. And you almost had to use the term elevated horror to either excuse your love for it or try to prop it up on a pedestal, because I've always said that by that logic, The Silence of the Lambs is like the Mount Everest of elevated horror. And you also had to do this because the fourth one majority of it was about like torture porn and things like that. But elevated horror, I mean, look at all the movies they name, like Hereditary, Babadook. Those were dominating the conversation of horror at the time. It wasn't the slashers, it was A24 for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, I was already saying A24.
Had become the dominant force in the genre to especially film snobs and people who are in the discourse, which this character clearly is. So I do think it's both reflective of how horror had changed and to the movie's message, of which it has several. It's structured in a lot of ways like The Force Awakens, where it's trying to evoke the original, both structurally, plot-wise, and even where certain scenes, I mean, this opening is the Drew Barrymore opening with some pretty clever subversions. But all in all, I'm at least seeing this movie does have a take. We can argue about its success, but I was sitting there going, all right, I don't think this is just going to be a run-of-the-mill, cash grab sequel.
Matt, when you went to this packed theater?
About as packed as you could be, given the circumstances.
So Ghostface asks if she's seen Stab, and she answers maybe once, but that's super 90s. And she's asked if she'd like to play a game, as her name is called. So we know right away Ghostface knows her name. She looks around and arms her house's security system. Phone rings again as she's told that she should answer it. She does, and she's told that it isn't Amber. He says that Amber is looking fetching, though, and she shouldn't leave her phone. He goes on with the game, and she asks to not ask her about Stab, ask her about elevated horror. But instead, he asks her about Sydney, which she gets right. He then asks who wrote the original book that the movie is based on, and she answers that chick from TV, and then right away just goes, Gail, Gail, Gail. And she asks who answered the phone, only to get carved up. And she says, fuck you, and Ghostface just tick, tick, ticks her down. He asks who the killer was in Stab 1. She answers Billy Loomis. He says it's not correct, as it's both Loomis and Stu Marker. So they are playing the exact same card here that the killer in the first one did with either Stu or Billy did with Drew Barrymore, in that they ask her, okay, so who's the killer in Friday the 13th? And she answers, Jason, Jason. They're like, nope, it's his mom. You got that wrong. Here, it's not just one killer, it's two killers. So again, Ghostface is playing with her head.
Playing with their head and also playing up the audience's expectations, because we've literally seen this before, right down to the trick question as the third one. But as far as incorporating modern technology, I do think one of the things this does well is that just because you have the resources at your disposal, like cell phones and the door locks, doesn't mean they're 100% always going to be in your favor, especially in something that's trying to be scary and suspenseful. I like the blunt text of this isn't Amber. Like the oh shit. So apparently Ghostface knows how to hack people's cell phones. But all in all, I really like this up to this point. I really like this opening.
That's why I think using the technology and finding a way to make it scary for today, the way that we would have back with those phones back in the 90s, I think they do a good job with it. Up until that question, the question of who was the, like, he, you can't play with singularity and plurality and then think it's a trick gotcha question. No, you didn't say killers, you said killer. So no.
Well, I think that's intentional because this movie has a lot to say about
Yes,
fandom,
it
entitlement,
does.
and always thinking you're 100% in the right and context be damned. Like, I think that's not just reflecting the original, that same beat, but it's also trying to hold up a mirror to how message boards are, where everyone needs to prove they know everything.
Adam, as somebody with an English degree, I was yelling at it the same exact way you were. I was like, you can't play with that language like that.
You have a writer on this podcast, and even I was like, oh, that's a little,
I gotta say, I was not expecting this movie to open because I knew that Jenna Ortega was in it, but I didn't know that she was the opening of the film. So I was like, damn, it's
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy because I'm like, we get Jenna Ortega, they're going to kill her off here, which blew me away. And then I'm just like, I realize this is a second horror movie that I'd seen her in because I've seen X,
Oh,
and
that's
it's,
right. She's in that.
but it blew my mind. I'm like, Jenna Ortega ends up then playing a teenager in Wednesday, but here she's old. She's had a kind of crazy career to start this off. Good for her.
Yeah. And this came out before Wednesday.
Yeah, this was
the first season would release later that year. So this wasn't quite the Drew Barrymore thing of having her be the biggest star of the new cast. This one, it's kind of unlike the first one where you had a bunch of unknowns and Drew Barrymore. This one, you have the, I don't want to say the burden, but you have the expectation of your three returning, Well, three publicized returning characters.
Mm-hmm. That was something I bumped up against with this because Drew Barrymore, she defined Generation X. She was be forever in our hearts because she was the one who hid E.T. You know what I'm saying? Like, she will always be that. I was trying to think, okay, who would I put in this opening kill? We're gonna find out there's a reason they don't kill her, and I get that. But it just kind of threw me off that you're going to go from Drew Barrymore to the chick who's going to be in Wednesday later on that year. It was just weird for me.
So are you trying to think of someone who defines like millennials?
Somebody.
So other than, I have two answers. Oh. If it's a woman, it's Emma Watson or Jennifer Lawrence.
See, Drew Barrymore was never nominated for an Oscar like Jennifer Lawrence was. Emma Watson, I could actually see.
But, you know, it has to be someone who's like directly, mm-hmm, when you think of that generation and like franchises at the time. I mean, Harry Potter is probably the biggest, but also she's not connected to horror. Then again, neither was Drew Barrymore.
So Ghostface says somebody has to die as she goes to the door, and there he is. She's stabbed in the stomach and backs off as she grabs a knife and closes the door. The system starts getting disarmed. The phone rings again, and Tara, with tears in her eyes, answers it. Ghostface asks a bonus question, which is, do you think I made it inside your house before you're able to rearm the system? And she gets grabbed, knocked down, and has her leg stomped on. Ow. That got me, but not as much as when the knife goes through her hand. That's when I was like, holy fuck. That was brutal. The cops pull up as she's getting stabbed in the background and reaches for the door, and here's the title cards.
With not having nearly the gore that we get in that Drew Barrymore opening, they change it because it is there's some vicious just body damage that Ghostface does here. And oof, damn. Yeah, that leg break was, that one got me.
Yeah, well, I was also surprised just that given this is a post-Weinstein movie that they were willing to go as far as they do with the violence against women in particular. Ghostface has always kind of not been one for style points, but there's some brutality in those previous movies. So I'm glad that they didn't feel like they had to shy away from that without going. It's not like Rob Zombie's Halloween, where there's just buckets of blood being dropped. I do think it's a bit absurd that this movie starts a trend where bleed outs are never a thing, which we talked about in one of the other movies. But I'm surprised she survived this.
I am, quite frankly. Yeah, not enough white trash to be a Rob Zombie film, too. So we have a pop song playing as Sam is drinking from a water bottle, and we meet Jack Quaid, Dennis Quaid, and Meg Ryan's son, who's playing Richie. She gets a text and calls Wes. Gee, I wonder who he's named after, as he tells her that Tara was attacked. And then he tells Sam that she's going to be okay as she asks if he knows who did it, and he responds it was somebody in a ghost face mask. Okay, here's Melissa Barrera. I get the whole thing. We're going to learn why she's much older than everybody. We're going to learn that she was their babysitter. We're also going to learn that their mom is in a conference. Now, plot hole number one for me. I don't care who you are. Adam, you are at a huge meeting overseas. You hear one of your kids, God bless them, was attacked in their house. You're going to fly right over there to see what the fuck is going on. The fact that we never meet this mother, and the fact that she's not even brought up as a suspect. I have a fix for this, which I'll get to later, but this is a huge ding I want to put against this movie, that they are trying to write their way out of something and they can't do it.
You know what's funny? I guess the biggest compliment I could give is I was never thinking of that leap in logic, because I got the sense that things were really estranged, and quite frankly, it's not something I thought of. I think your point has a lot of validity to it, but I can't say it's one of the marks I hold against the movie overall, as far as like, I don't want to call it a plot hole, but you can certainly get around that.
I feel like these writers kind of constantly rewrote stuff, and I think it gets apparent as you get through it. Apparent. But these films have not been interested in the parents whatsoever, unless they're calling mom sluts.
Or so, the mom is the killer, in the second.
In the second one, yeah. So maybe less is better, but I barely feel like this is a high school movie. I'm sorry, but this is 90210, the college years, trying to pretend they're still in high school. There's almost no reason for this to be in high school, and I really don't feel like it is, even though it's telling us it is.
Well, I'm trying to think. Jenna Ortega was probably like 18 when they made this.
She's the closest.
I think she's the only. Her and Wes are the only two that I think look high school age.
Yeah, but Wes looks high school age because he's freaking Freddie Prinze Jr. tipped his hair.
Yeah, I think that was done intentionally to make him look younger.
Me too.
Well, I think it was intentional to have the blonde hair just for the scene where he dies in, but we'll get there. So Sam tells Richie, who of course we're going to find out knows this already, and he hugs her and tells her that he's going to be coming with her. And then we get a Drew Barrymore voice cameo. Did you guys catch that? She's the voice.
Yeah, I thought that was clever.
I did too, actually. That
That's a nice way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think this movie, for the most part, does a good job with those little Easter eggs.
Thank you for saying for the most part.
But having said that, like, you know, I was thinking of Star Wars a lot watching this movie. To me, that's a lot more clever than just literally showing the freaking chessboard on the Millennium Falcon. Like, there was actual thought put into a bunch of these. Mm. I mean, there's one big one where I'm like, oh my God, for God's sake.
So we have Cuba Gooding's son playing Chad. We have a gal by the name of Sonia Amor. She's playing Liv. Mikey Madison, as I mentioned, Oscar winner for Amor. She's playing Amber. Jasmine Savoy Brown, she's playing Mindy. And Kyle Gardner in a very, very small role playing Vince. And we have Dylan Minnette playing Wes, who gives advice on how to avoid Ghostface. All right, how do we feel about this little get-together? By the way, one of only five scenes that Amber is in. Keep that in mind.
They get what they're doing. I get what they're showing us. Obviously, I fully understand how they're putting these together. This group have the personality of Todd, unflavored. And by the end of this film, if you put up pictures and put up names, I couldn't match them to one another. I don't care about these people throughout the entire film. I don't feel like they do enough to differentiate. I don't feel like any of them have moments and personalities that I have fun with like I do with that original film. So this feels like mandatory studio casting and people, and I don't feel like anybody here is somebody that I still connect with like I do with that original film.
Okay, so you said like that original film. I'm going to throw this at you. Did you care about Rose McGowan's Tatum in the first film?
Yeah. Okay. Like she sticks out, not just because she literally pokes out, but there's something about that character who, you know, you remember her, right? She's got lines, she's quippy. There's something about the way she delivers it. I don't feel like any of these people deliver something in a way that I'm like, oh, that's funny. Other than, you know, Mikey Madison freaking just looking like the killer from the second she walks on screen. Everybody's just there to fill out. I hate freaking saying this, but I feel like they're there to fill out a modern day quota for these films.
So I think they actually have more personality on the whole than the friend group in almost any of these movies. And I kind of would argue even more than the first one. I think they're archetypical, much like the first one, but I think this one, it's almost done with a wink and a nod right down to the obvious diversity angle they were going for, because I think that there is some commentary there. But I don't want to say I rebuff Adam's point, but I don't have the issue with the... I don't think that they're blocks of wood, and I also don't think they're as one note and cartoony as we saw in like three, as an example, with all the all like the actors who are playing the characters. But it's also kind of a weird balancing act. This was my point. I kind of wish this was all or nothing. Either focus entirely on the legacy characters or don't have them at all and really flesh all these out. I think that's also one of the things when you look at like The Force Awakens, where it's like, I really like Finn and Rey and Poe, but they get separated from one another, and also Han kind of takes over the movie, and like there's a lot of stuff that, a lot of balls in the air. I feel like this one kind of has that to a degree.
I think this one does a better job, and we are going to just keep comparing it because it's the horror equivalent of that. This does a better job of flipping those legacy characters in, because we don't see them for quite a while. We're going to spend quite a bit of time with these people, and so I think in that way, I think it's better written, but I don't know whose side. I think I'm more on Matt's side. I do like these people for the most part. But the fact is, we meet them for 2-3 minutes here, and then we're going to see them for two scenes. And, well, I'll get to the end, but it feels like there was a dartboard, somebody threw a dart, and that's where the killers landed. And so, like, we spend 5 minutes with them total, and one of them's going to end up being the killer.
I think that's where some of my issue goes, is I think there's way too many people populating this film when you add in the legacy cast. Look, I love Jasmine Savoy Brown and things. She doesn't do anything in this film for the most part. I know that Sam and Tara are going to be the new characters because they're sisters and everything else, but I've also got Chad, and I got Wes, and I got Amber, but then I'm getting Dewey back. I got Gail back. I know Sydney's showing up, and then they keep going when they bring back another character as well as Wes's mom, which blew me away. They keep going that these people don't have time. And because they don't have time, and you don't give them little quirks that are kitschy and fun, I just don't care about them.
Well, Mindy is literally the Randy of this. You know how I know that? Because she's related to him. Like, everybody in this cast is related to somebody from that first film.
Which I also think that was done as a satirical point. Not just Star Wars, but like Halloween. It's about Laurie and her family. You know, this is something that's been done even in these previous movies. Like, part of the calling card and the fun of, like, two is, oh, the killer is Billy's mom, or Roman is Sydney's, like, half-brother. Like, that's been a hallmark of this franchise, and I like that this one just cranks it up to 11, to the point where even Maury Povich would be like, all right, I am getting out of Dodge, because this is ridiculous.
Richie is telling Sam that he's never seen Stab or Gone with the Wind, and Sam is...
Well, the latter, you're not missing much. I'm on his side. Like, you can go your whole life without seeing that movie.
Sam is giving him the lowdown of the film, which he compares to Halloween. Of course, Richie asks, who would want to put on a mask and try killing her sister? Sam shows up with Richie as she hugs Wes, compliments his hair, and goes to Amber, saying that she used to babysit them all. Because we need some reason to explain why she's 25 and hanging out with high schoolers.
And you know what? That's as good as a reason as you're going
to
come up with.
Well, it goes back to Halloween, doesn't it? Because she was a babysitter.
Right.
And I thought of.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I never thought of that.
And I'm also okay with it. Like, I'm like, all right, explanation, and I move on. But I'm thrown off at the beginning that our opening kill isn't a kill. It takes me forever for my mind to wrap around that.
Well, again, we're going to find out why that is later on in the film. Yeah, that threw me off, too, until they give the reason.
Yeah. It's also the redux point.
Exactly.
Can't 100% do the same thing, and I like that this one, in a movie that's all about, like, familiarity and trying to recreate, I like that that's the thing, the opening is arguably the biggest deviation for the franchise as a whole, as far as bucking a trend.
And I think it's smart, because it keeps you slightly off balance, because if that's a way to change what you think you're getting, how many other paint-by-numbers are suddenly going to use the wrong color paint to fill it in? And I think it was a smart move. It blew me away, because I'm like, why does she live? How does she live? What's going on? It was smart.
And it's also, I think this is a clever thing. It sort of, as an audience member, it makes you lower your guard and think that, oh, everyone's going to have plot armor. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, obviously there's going to be some people that die, but it leaves that in your mind that, like, the people I like are probably going to be the ones that survive. Mm-hmm. And I think that was also done. Where it's like, oh, if she could survive this, then these people should be fine.
I did think they suddenly watered it down and, whoop, I was wrong.
Chad is telling the group how cool Sam is, but Amber puts that to bed pretty quick, saying how Sam actually left on Tara's 18th birthday. We're hearing possible motives, with Mindy pointing out that Wes has a crush on Tara. And then we see a little fight break out with Vince pulling a switchblade out. We're sure to get a close-up on that as we cut to him taking a leak and having his truck rev up as a song that has played in all the previous films blasts from his speakers. Kyle Gardner here for what, two scenes? Gone!
Well, he was also only here as a consolation because he auditioned for Richie and didn't get it.
Yeah, true.
It's almost obligatorily they make the offhand, oh, that's Stu's nephew.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes,
almost to be like, yes, we are going to make sure every strain of family bonds are going to be connected in this particular movie.
Which, why wasn't he the one who had Stu's? Okay, we'll get there. So Vince approaches the truck as Ghostface appears behind him and stabs him down, and then we get the cleaning of the blade, which they hadn't done in a few films. So then we're watching Sam take some pills, and then, oh boy, we get a storyline they took straight from House Season 4, Adam, with Billy appearing behind her in a mirror and talking to her, asking if she's ever going to tell them why this is happening. With Skeet Ulrich looking like, my God, the de-aging on Luke Skywalker in The Mandalorian wasn't as bad as this, and... Adam, I don't know if you remember, but remember that season in House where he killed the nurse the year before in a bus accident and she came back in his thoughts because he was taking pills and hallucinating her? That's exactly what I thought of every single time he appeared here. God, I hated the inclusion of Skeet Ulrich in this. It's so bad.
Dug this.
Oh my God.
I smell a fight.
What, for somebody who's aged a couple decades? Even this de-aging looks better than some of how our other legacy characters look. I don't think he looks bad, but trying to make him look back in his 25 playing 17-year-old self, you got some issues there. But again, I don't know what this means, and I like it. Because I do think it opens the possibility that they're going to swerve me and she's going to be the killer the whole time. Because there's something different about this Ghostface right off the bat. He's stabbing, he or she, they are stabbing differently. It's different moves. they're acting a little different, and I don't know what's going on. As much as I roll with everybody being connected to everything, like Matt, you guys brought up, it's kind of a hallmark of this series, and her being, you know, I'll put it back, her being psycho bitch, like Amber in House. Oh my God, it's Amber. That was the name, and we got an Amber in this. Oh, that's funny. I like it, and I like that I don't know if she's done it the whole time or if it's somebody else or what. So yeah, I like this way to include Billy.
All right, before I get to Matt, I have a couple of things I want to say real quick. A, I never like seeing people's inner thoughts like this. I think it's lazy. I think you consolidate this in either exposition or have the actor actually act like she's struggling. B, the big problem with this movie and this plot line is I never believe Melissa Barrera can be the psycho that they're trying to make her seem like she is. I never believe she would turn on that psycho button and be the killer in this. There was never ever a point where I felt like this was going to pan out in that way. So I know we don't come to these movies for believability, but one thing about that first movie is when you go back and watch it, and I said this in that review, you always see, and you can always put A and B together as to who was doing what killing at what time. There's never a point where I believe that she is doing the killing in this, because I just don't think she can do it.
All right, well, I'm going to piss one of you off. It's going to be the guy who just talked, because I'm with Adam 100%. This was something, for one thing, I appreciate this was not publicized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was purposefully done. A, because his character's been dead since 1996, along with his career, quite frankly. And B, they put the spotlight on the main three that this kind of was allowed to permeate without being at the forefront. And I like this because, from a writing perspective, I like sort of the unreliable narrator. And it's not that I believe or disbelieve that Sam could be the one doing these attacks, but I like the whole temptation aspect and treating mental health as something that you don't just take a pill and 100% you're cured. Like, there are those ebbs and flows. I mean, this is obviously an extreme with your father being a serial killer, but from a conceptual idea, I 100% dig this. The de-aging thing is just weird because that technology is never going to look 100% right, because you can't, there's just certain like skin tones and weaning out the wrinkles that you just can't 100% do without looking like they're wearing saran wrap over their face. And they get around that in this movie because he's almost always in the reflection. So you're looking through an initial layer of artifice on top of the digital technology. Like, if he was physically there standing behind her, I think that would have looked a little bit more distracting. It would have looked like, remember in X-Men 3, the opening of that, where they de-aged Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen? And it looks like a cutscene of a video game.
I think the mirror helps, yeah.
Man, it's fitting that Rian Johnson's mentioned in this movie, because this is Last Jedi all over again. So Sam's phone rings as she answers and is told by Ghostface that he is somebody who knows her family secret. She says, come and get her, and he responds with pleasure and attacks. She's stabbed at in the cafeteria. She runs into a guard who, of course, sees nothing when he goes into the break room.
Do they not have cameras at this hospital?
Does nobody in this film have... They all need hearing tests. Okay, if he is standing 5 feet away behind a door, you should be able to hear stereophonic sound that you know somebody else is speaking, not just in the phone up to your ear. The amount of times he is standing and talking. Jesus Christ.
I don't know how many times. This series does it over and over where these hospitals are just vacant.
But I do like, if you're watching this movie trying to piece who the killers are, if you notice the way Tara and Richie talk to each other, there's something off almost immediately that you can pick up on. And also when, you know, he leaves the room and comes back, I like that they're, much like the first one, they're making it so obvious that the boyfriend is the killer, to where this movie literally calls it out 20 minutes from now. And I think there is something intentional with casting a Nepo baby as an entitled fanboy.
Of course.
Which is weird also because he looks a lot like his mom. I don't see any of Dennis Quaid.
Oh my God, that sneer he does. He looks exactly like Dennis Quaid did. Yeah.
Maybe it's because Jack Quaid can actually act. And I've never.
That's true.
I've never thought, outside of The Substance, that might be the only thing I've liked Dennis Quaid in God knows how long.
Yeah, go back to Jaws 3 if you want to hear our thoughts on him. So
mine. Coming soon.
Yeah. Sam's getting questioned by Lemon Square Woman herself, Sheriff Hicks, who says that she remembers Sam and all the trouble that she used to cause. She tells Sam to hit the road and leave her city for those who actually care for it. Adam, it seems that you like seeing Sheriff Hicks, Marley Shelton, back.
Okay. If there is a benefit to watching these now in the order that we're doing and kind of rewatching them, and to people who rewatch things before new movies come out, because it'd been 11 years between this one and the other one, right? 11, 12 years?
Yeah.
11 years. So to pull back freaking Sheriff Hops, I'm like, this pops me. I'm like, this is, and hey, I love a lemon square. You know, lemon bars, you got me. Mama's getting me to come over to her house. So this just, I thought this was a cool addition. I sure as hell was not expecting this.
I wasn't either. I'm glad Matt kept quiet about this last week. I'm like you, it popped me too.
Well, I appreciate that this movie doesn't do the thing that a lot of these franchises do of, we're going to cherry pick the movies that matter. I think all of them are referenced in some degree or another, whether it's legacy characters returning, which, you know, no shit. But I think all of them get some acknowledgement, and it doesn't feel like they're leaving, because it could have been very easy to just pretend Scream 3 never happened.
Of course.
I mean, it would have also been very easy to act like this is taking the place of Scream 4. Like, you go from 1, 2, and 3 to this. But no, this makes, it makes Scream 4 mattered, because it could have easily been disconnected.
Especially because that had been a thing that had been happening in movies. We'd seen it, so it would not have been a stretch to go that way, especially with the renaming of this, or the reusable naming of this. So yeah, that they don't do that, I'll give them props for it.
Richie and Amber are kicked out of Tara's room by Sam, who talks about why Dad left and if Tara remembers when their mom had boxes in the attic. She says she read the diaries that were contained in there and wanted to find out how romantic it must have been when her mom and dad got pregnant with her. But this is when she found out that Billy is actually her dad. Her mom cheated on her dad with Billy, and when she approached her mom, she saw that her dad was standing behind her. And this is why her dad left and why she became distant and did all the drugs that she did. And this is how she found out there was no Santa Claus.
Spoiler. Well, I also like that retroactively, this makes, it's like an extra knife in Sid that he was probably sleeping around around the time the first one came out. Yeah, because the mom would probably be the same age Nev Campbell is, just about.
But to your guys' point, they are trying so hard to make her into Sydney's mom because she's the quote-unquote slut, right?
I hate this.
I do too.
Like, it's just the way that they just treat women's sexuality is the reason that all this goes down. And that they doubled down on it in this film, I think it's a shitty move. I really do.
But how else are you going to get Billy involved? He's dead.
I know, but that it's because they're cheating.
You could have done it.
She didn't have to be cheating on a dad to do it.
True.
No, she could have been the product of rape, which, again, is also, like, sleazy.
Or separated, that her and her dad got together afterwards. Because, you know, just so many different ways. But, oh, we got to have a cheating. Like, I'm sorry to you writers that are fucking nerds that you keep getting cheated on in Hollywood, but stop putting it in your product.
So Tara gets pissed and kicks her out. Boy, I wish she would have done that five lines before, because she sounded like Phoebe Cates toward the end there. She runs into Richie, who says that he was listening at the door. He says that it kind of freaks him out that her real dad was a serial killer, and she calls out that this is the part where the audience is yelling at the screen for the characters to get the fuck out. He replies that he loves her, and she says that he's a dumbass, and they need to talk to an expert. Who's that expert? Well, somehow they get the address to Dewey's trailer, and once you know it, he's down and out, living on alcohol. We've never seen this trope, ever.
Hell, this is freaking, he is Luke in The Last Jedi.
He's Luke in The Last Jedi. He's Indiana Jones. I mean.
Well, he's Laurie Strode in 2018's Halloween.
Yes. I will say this, though. I had no idea that, this is going to sound terrible, it's a backhanded compliment. I never knew that David Arquette could act. He actually does pretty well in these scenes. I like him in this.
Well, this is very Mark Hamill in Last Jedi, where it's like, maybe it's just because he's older and maybe a little bit disgruntled with what's happened to his career, but I think this is the best he's been in this entire franchise.
Agreed.
And honestly, I was annoyed that they were bringing everyone back, but given this was the first introduction and how I see the through, like, I am always annoyed with these legacy characters. Like, their lives are now as miserable as possible. Look what they did with Sarah Connor in the last Terminator movie, where, oh yeah, John still got killed. But it makes sense that it was not going to last between him and Gale, especially with what you see in 4. And he's, you know, he was probably forced to retire because of the limp. You know, he's kind of mad at the world, but I like that he still finds it in him to do the right thing, and he's not, as we'll see, like, he's not angry at everybody. It's just he's almost like, I should have moved away rather than just stick here. But yeah, to your point, I was kind of surprised how good he was in this. I know that's kind of a low bar, but I was genuinely impressed.
Now, Adam, as the person who's been the most critical of Dewey David Arquette this entire series, how do you feel he did here?
Like him. I think it's good. I think, and my first note is, oh man, this is the quick cameo, but at least it's a worthy spot because he's bringing him in to give the rules, and I think that's all we're going to get out of him. I think he, and this is about the best thing I could say because of how much, and this is going to be the first mention of it in this one, how much Scary Movie tied into all the Scream franchises. This is the first time I'm not thinking of Officer Doofy and Officer Dewey, and that's a big compliment. I think he's bringing something here, and yeah, I like this Dewey quite a bit, and I've liked the character. It's just, man, he goes through almost as much shit as Sydney does.
But it's also literally, this is Han and Leia, mm-hmm. where they're separated. Clearly something happened. The only difference is, I mean, look, he's wearing the old dusty jacket. He looks disheveled like Harrison Ford did. I mean, granted, he's not as old. And his role in this movie is very similar to how Han was used in Force Awakens. The difference is nobody walked into this movie saying, oh yeah, Dewey's going to be offed as the only way he comes back.
I do like the way they get around the rights issues here as he's watching Gale on Good Morning Something, but we don't know if it's Good Morning America, but because it's covered up. I thought that was clever. So Sam and Richie show up at the door, and boy, it sure doesn't take long for them to convince him to listen to them. And this is when he grabs a Scream mask and throws it over his shoulder, which is a Last Jedi reference, guys. Never mind.
I get it.
He's... God damn, tough crowd tonight. He says that he'll give them 2 minutes to talk, and Dewey is asking if he knows who her dad is, and he needs to be a suspect, as rule number one is never trust a loved one. Rule number two is the killers are always connected to the past, and rule number three is that the killer always has a friend group and that the killer is a part of, and she needs to look for the killer in her sister's friends. So he's right in this, but Matt, do we have to have the rules seen every single movie?
Yeah, it's a hallmark in the same way that Bond always had a Q scene. Like, it's part of the DNA of this franchise. And I like that it comes from him, and he's just very straightforward because he's, like, cynical and kind of burned out. He's like, I've lived through this 4 times. It's kind of the similar thing that we get from Sydney later on, where he's like, I'm just going to regurgitate what you need to know and then get out of my life. Or so we think. And to Adam's point, I thought this was all we were going to get.
Boy, do I wish this was all we were going to get. He says he's been stabbed 9 times and he has a limp. As Sam says that if she's in danger, then he's in danger. He says your time is up as we cut to outside. And Richie says he's much cooler in the movies.
Which is weird because he's played by Luke Wilson. Like, how much of a downgrade is that?
We see Dewey grab a phone as we cut to Sydney running with the carriage as she answers it. And, you know, it's just funny that Sydney is never one to run away from her problems. But the very first scene we see her, she's running, so I think there's something to that as well. He says that things are good in the sheriff's business and that he hasn't spoken to Gale in a couple years. He then says that it's happening again and something about this set of events just feels different. She asks if he's okay. He then asks Sydney if she has a gun, and he makes her promise not to come. So of course, that means that she's going to come there. She then says that she's glad Dewey's there to protect them. And Dewey then opens a box with his gun and badge in it. Guess the station didn't want them back. As we hear the Dewey theme music, and he comes up saying that he's decided to temporarily assist their investigation. Boy, oh boy. So, how long does it take? 30 minutes for him to just decide, you know what? I think I'm going to join them anyway.
Well, Han did the same thing. Mm-hmm. Luke did the same thing. Like, I'm trying to think of like any... I mean, if you want to go to the best example with Creed, didn't take Rocky all that much convincing.
Well, it did just because of the emotion he had to, and we'll get to this later this year, but the emotion he had with Apollo is why I thought, but.
He doesn't do it while they're walking to the car.
Yeah. Yeah,
normally, exactly. Normally they're still in the driveway when someone walks out of the house.
I also like the detail of he doesn't call Gail. He just texts her being like, and I think the comedy's interwoven pretty well where he's like, oh, I shouldn't have sent the smiley face.
Yes. I feel like it's conversations these two had in a lawyer's office.
The best stuff in this movie involves Dewey and Gale and their interactions. We then go to Randy's sister's house. This character that was so lazily inserted into Scream 3 has moments here. We have a big old mural of Randy on the wall. And this is where Sam tells them that she is the daughter of Billy Loomis. And the friends are asking why it couldn't be Dewey. And Dewey puts it right back on Wes. And we hear that the first 3 attacks are related to the original killer. I do like the fact that Sam is telling them that Billy is her dad. And they're like, oh, okay, where's the beer? They don't give a shit.
Well, because it's also that thing of, like, you're looking at Gen Zs don't care about the past as much as the filmmakers do in most of these movies. But I also like that this is not set up to be, like, a third act reveal, and it makes everyone turn on her. I like that they're just up front and get this out of the way, because I hate that trope in movies.
And we've already had a rule scene, but we get another one as Mindy puts together that this is a requel, and that people are complaining that Stab 8 pissed on their childhoods. And Mindy,
now, it's very specific they picked the number 8.
Yep, of course.
Which was episode 8.
Yep, of course.
And they mentioned Rian Johnson by name.
And you can't do remakes like Flatliners, Black Christmas, and Child's Play 2019. You have to do something new. New main characters are supported by and related to legacy characters.
There's a problem. Child's Play did do something different.
I know.
I do have an issue with the way that this is paced, because we went from a exposition scene to transition to an exposition scene. And I feel like some of this is reshot, some of this is... But if you can't explain your film naturally throughout the course of the film, rewrite it a little bit. It's just, I feel like this just takes a giant chunk and slows everything down. I like these scenes, but to back them up like this is poor.
And it's also, they're trying to condense it as much as possible, doing it back to back, so you don't have to keep start stop, because the first one, there's multiple scenes where they talk about the rules. I mean, this there is, but they're back to back, and they literally get it all out of the way.
I'd like that it's his family. Like, this is fun. It's funny. It's fun. It's kitschy. It's a little silly for a Scream movie, but I'm okay with it, because I feel like it takes some of the piss out of Scary Movie. But this is fun.
Mindy says it always goes back to the original, and Sam realizes that she's the star of a set of fan fiction. Dewey says that he's starting to regret coming here. Mindy says that it's clear that Sam is the killer. Sam storms out and drives away, as Richie says that the first rule of these movies is not to split up. But Billy appears in the mirror again and tells her to use it! Oh, wait, that's Blade. Never mind. He encourages her to cut some fucking throats as she stops and yells no.
Well, it's a Blade.
We then cut to Sheriff Julie Hicks, who hears a noise and picks up a knife. She wanders through the house with the knife in hand as she closes the back door, and Wes appears in front of her. She asks if he's being safe, and she says that the sushi is set to pick up, so she's going to go ahead and go get it. He then gets up to take a shower as she leaves and tells him to go lock the door.
I also found it funny, and I think this was intentional. The main characters are women. But the shower scene with him is shot like he was a woman.
Of course. I mean, they have the full thing of the right up the nozzle, too. Right up the shower nozzle when he walks in. It's the same exact thing.
But it's also like, I like when the killer's on the phone and says, have you ever seen Psycho? And they literally cut to the shot of the shower.
Yeah, and he's blonde, too. You know, and I'm sure if you put this right next to Psycho, it would be probably right to the minute of him going into the shower.
I can't help but think how much he looks like Freddie Prinze and I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Oh, God.
That's what I'm thinking they're aping here with this guy. Blonde tips in 22?
Really? We see the stream come straight out of the nozzle, as I mentioned, and we have the inverse of this not being a blonde woman, but a blonde guy in the shower. Meanwhile, Hicks takes a call from Ghostface, who asks what her favorite scary movie is, and she responds that she likes animated movies and musicals. She is then invited to come to the station, and he'll tell her all about the two people he killed, which includes her baby boy. So she calls Wes, who isn't picking up the phone, as she speeds home with the red sirens blaring. Ghostface even calls out Psycho as she begs him not to hurt her son. He says that she's not going to make it on time as we go back to the shower. Judy comes home and runs to the door, only to meet Ghostface's knife. She falls and gets stabbed in the neck, which seems to be this Ghostface's MO, right? Like, there's a lot of neck stabbing in this one.
Yeah, Ghostface doesn't get a lot of style points in this one, but I like that in this movie, Ghostface is a lot meaner. The clumsiness is still there, but it's not as much at the forefront.
I thought this was actually a very creative kill, very well done misdirection. You know, she's running to the door.
Well, I like it's broad, like, it's like broad daylight, but it works in a way that the Randy 1 and 2 just does not, because this is like in suburbia. Not in the middle of a freaking college campus.
But here's the way my percolated media mind works. I'm trying to dissect this. Okay, so we know that the killers are Richie and Amber. Well, Richie is with Sam. We get that. But Amber, I guess, would have to rush, get here in time, beat her home, which I guess she could. But she's also way tall in this scene. And she is, what, 5'2", maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it could be Richie, because we don't 100% know, like, they're not joined at the hip necessarily, because they could be staying, because we see there's parts in this movie where Richie's by himself eating a pizza.
And then another thing I hate, the very next set of scenes is Wes opening door after door without Ghostface being there. Are you kidding me with this bullshit? I'm sure even James Wan was laughing at how many false scares were here. This is, fucking 20 minutes of opening and closing doors, which I guess is what they were going for. You know, they want to play with that trope. They want to make fun of it, but it's just once is enough, guys.
I was laughing because the first time I noticed is when he shuts the door to his own private bathroom and private shower. So he opens like three doors to get out of his own bathroom, but they do it with every door. They do it with the cabinet. They do it with the fridge. You at some point you got to stop spoofing and get back to Hills, and thank good they do. Cause man, Wes gets it.
By who is the question? Wes is setting up an awesome looking brunch as he sees a note about there being some lemon squares. So we get that little Easter egg. He hears sirens as he looks toward the front door. He opens it only to close and lock it. But of course, Ghostface is right there, and here's when he gets a knife to the throat, again, as he falls. So, as I mentioned, you know, I don't know which Ghostface this is. I think this kill's okay, but it's just too fucking drawn out. And this movie's already too long.
This is, this movie's too, all these movies from here on out are too long, I'm going to say. This is the first time that I don't think I'll call it the Ghostface math works, and I stopped thinking about it. I feel like every other time they gave care and time to make sure that everything lined up. I don't think these guys are interested in it. And I think that rewrites, reshoots, insert shots, of which there's a lot of reshoots and rewrites, and I think it becomes obvious. I think it gets away from them.
I was laughing at how drawn out it was to the point where I thought there's no way it wasn't intentional. But again, I like that we're not being so elaborate. It's just stab in the neck and move on.
We see Sam show up to the crime scene as police tell her that she can't be there and that Wes and the sheriff are just not around. The officer apologizes to her as a red-coated Gail walks up to her, and Sam says, "You're you." Gail asks if she knew the sheriff, and they both say that she didn't like either of them, which I thought was a good line. Gail then sees Dewey as she hits him, saying that he told her the killer was back by texting her. She says that she was here because she was worried about him, and Dewey says that he remembers what happened. He says they asked him to retire and that he made his choices, as did she. And I actually like the scene between the two. I didn't realize how much I wanted it until it happened. You know, unlike Leia and Luke, you know, people coming back to this after years away wanted, and they delivered it. I like the scene a lot.
Like Han and Leia's return. I like it for Indiana Jones. I like it here. I think this is good. I feel like these two are working out their couples therapy on screen. I feel like some of these conversations were held in lawyers' offices. I like these two quite a bit. I think that it's amazing that after everything they went through, because they tried to be cordial, and then at some point they really weren't. I think they work well on screen together, and I appreciate their professionality in getting this done this way. I like these two.
The only thing that really bothers me is just how quickly she gets there, given the very fast turnaround time and given her schedule. I mean, especially since like they mentioned she hasn't written anything in a while, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. Now she's back here for the story, but she's a national reporter at this, like a national public figure. So it's not like she needs the money. I kind of would have wanted a more concrete reason beyond just, the text.
Well, aren't they trying to set her up as a suspect? Maybe.
Yeah, but I never
bought it. I never felt that.
I mean, I haven't bought it for five films, but it's there.
And same with Dewey. Like, I never felt like it was going to be any of the legacy characters were going to be the killer.
We cut to Richie eating Pizza Hut and watching the one staff film that the Looper guy made, which involves a muscular tattooed ghost face carrying around a flamethrower. I have to say, I'd rather be watching that one.
I gotta say, I've eaten a lot of pizza in my time. They don't put the logo on the inside of the box. This film has got product placement that would make Wayne's World blush. I can't believe how bad. And this is when I notice it, because it's ridiculously in your face, and I can't help but notice it every scene here on out. This is an offensive level of product placement. This thing paid for itself completely in freaking ads of Mountain Dew and Pizza Hut and Doritos here on out. This is a comedy level of product ads.
Sam leaves, realizing that her sister is in trouble as we cut to the hospital. Tara is hearing noises as she says, "Fuck this," and tries standing up. She gets her in her wheelchair as the lights go out. The hospital's
also, go ahead. We talked about this on a previous show. When you unclip yourself from the reader, a swarm of MAs will come to check on you. Yeah, nobody works in this goddamn hospital.
Yeah, the hospitals in these movies must be making a fortune because they sure as hell don't hire anybody to watch the fucking halls or...
Like, gee, apparently this is just a world where Obamacare is like the greatest thing in the world and we don't need actual employees because... There's like one or two cops and that's it. And hospitals usually have their own generators.
Yes.
Because it'd be a huge problem if the power cut out and a bunch of people died because they were on life support. So the fact that power gets cut is, look, I'm not trying to make these logic questions in a Scream movie because we cherry picked all these movies. But this is one where I was like, this is a bit too far for me.
Adam, as somebody who pointed that out in the fourth Scream podcast we did that drive you nuts too?
Not only that, but I'm just, as a victim of a serial killer who's back that has notoriety over decades, there would be armed guards stationed everywhere around where she is. So that she's just there for the pickings is fucking ridiculous.
Sam is trying to call Tara as she's pulling herself through the halls and sees the dead guard. She sees that the gun was taken as she wheels around and runs into Richie. Richie is attacked as the phone rings and Ghostface answers it. He says that Sam can choose to save one, Richie or her sister, so we have a Batman Forever scenario going on here, or so we think.
This is where it's weird. Kate, as much as we got some pretty decent kills, Ghostface does a lot of not killing in this film. Mm-hmm. I gotta say, and we haven't had that before, but there's a lot of no kills.
Yeah, the body count in this is distressingly low for a slasher film.
It is, but this one also makes sense given that Richie's one of the killers. Like, you notice that's not a fatal blow, and she very... Like, it looks convincing as far as the door, but that's not a death blow.
Oh, speaking of death blows, so the elevator dings as Sam says that she was just stalking for time. Dewey shoots away as there's a struggle between Dewey and Ghostface. Everybody's just kind of standing around watching. Dewey says not today as he shoots Ghostface down. Now he has a chance to get himself and everyone out, but of course he says that they always come back. He leaves the elevator, and instead of, like, shooting him from a distance, he approaches the this proves to be his undoing, and my God, this... I not since Han was thrown off a fucking non-railed bridge was I as pissed as I was watching Dewey get it here. This fucking enraged me. I hated this so much. I have zero feeling toward this death.
This made me mad. I understand you're going to kill him off. You got to find ways. Find a better way. To have Dewey, one, be... He's not a stormtrooper. Dewey can hit his shots when he needs to. But to do it like this, to not finish... To have somebody go through what he's gone through and not finish it off, he I don't feel like he's this sloppy, lazy, and dumb. Yeah, this kind of pissed me off. So, I'm sorry. Give me credits at the hour five time, because this was just some dumbass, not clever writing that pissed me off. I agree. Damn it, Dewey.
This didn't bother
Here comes
me.
The defense. Here comes the defense. I guarantee it.
Yeah, this didn't bother me. If anything, I was surprised they killed him, which I have to give. I always get points when I don't see a death coming, especially in these types of movies. The only way I get around it, like, I'm not mad at the how it's done because A, he's got a limp. B, he's probably missed a step because he hasn't shot a gun in a long time. And he's an alcoholic as on display. And that really fucks with your ability to use firearms. And also, like, has he ever in the previous movies, this is a serious question, been the person to be the one who shoots the killer dead?
Deliver the final blow? No.
Yeah. So, like, if Sidney was this dumb, I would have been bothered by it. And I'm not trying to call Dewey an idiot, but he's never been the one to, like, say, oh, they always come back. But the fact that he calls that out here and still gets killed, that part bothers me. But I appreciate that with these legacy characters, a lot of time, they're treated as, like, untouchable, unless you were Han, but everyone, Stevie Wonder saw that coming. But in almost every other movie, the legacy characters live on. I mean, Rocky beat cancer as decisively as he beat Clubber Lang in the Creed movies. So... I endorse this being done, especially there's still 30 minutes left of the movie. Like, I thought if someone was going to die, it would have been there. But much like Drew Barrymore in the first film, this sort of sets up that, oh, nobody is safe.
I get why Richie's not doing anything about this, but everybody else is just standing there. They're watching this character who they know has a limp, who they know is an alcoholic, just struggle with this and not do anything about it. It's just there for theatrics, and that's where it drives me nuts.
Well, my counter would be, what did Ray and Finn do when they watched Han get tossed into the fucking off
the
bridge?
Well, that was a father-son moment, though. This isn't father-son. This is killer ex-cop. Oh, God. The knife is dug deep into Dewey's chest as Ghostface twists it and kicks Dewey down. We then cut to Gail, who's running in slow motion and sees that Dewey is loaded onto the ambulance. She's crying, and my God, you'd think Gandalf died here with all the fucking choirs going on in the background.
I think this is
satirical. I care more about this one.
I think this is kind of satirical. If you notice all the big exposition scenes where people are being dramatic, like they're heightening the music almost to an 11, because it's also the whole like hospital scene where she tells, oh, Billy's my dad. I think it's done almost to be very operatic in the same way that elevated horror, they're trying to elevate these scenes. The difference is what I like about this, there's a couple minutes where they devote to like letting the characters and you as the audience process that Dewey died. Because if you remember like Force Awakens, yeah, Han is killed. The climax happens and there's like 2 seconds of acknowledgement when they get back.
I think they want us to care. I think they want us to take this serious. I do think this is being used for dramatic purposes. This is a character we've spent 4.5 movies on. And if that was their intent, well, that makes me even more angry at them and this movie. And it makes it even dumber in my eyes, because say what we will about Dewey, and we all had various things to say about him, he was a well-loved character. And to make him into a death, let alone a satirical death... Wrong choice.
Well, I don't think they're satirizing the fact that he died. It's that, you know, to make you feel it.
Sam then approaches Gale and says that she's sorry, as she didn't know him well, but he helped her, and if it wasn't for him, Tara would be dead. And this is when Sydney shows up, and they hug as she says that she's sorry. And by the way, this is when we find out that she married McDreamy, which, okay, bring that character back, even though Patrick Dempsey said, fuck no.
But again, they're acknowledging that three still counts.
I said, I wasn't going to look it up because they said she married, they gave a name, and obviously it meant something, but I wasn't going to go back and look.
Yeah, Kincaid was Patrick Dempsey's character in 3.
Okay.
We just talked about that. Pay attention while we do these, will you?
That name mattered. He was in that movie less than Sidney's in this one.
You're not wrong.
I got to say, don't take McDreamy to Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, yeah, because then your mom won't leave him alone.
Yeah, right. So they sit down as Tara tells Sam that she has better painkillers. Sam apologizes for not telling Tara sooner, and then she tells Tara that she's never going to leave again. She says that she was scared that she would turn out just like her dad, so she ran to protect her from both her dad and her. They exchange I love yous, and Sam says that they're going to get the fuck out of Woodsboro, which is the right choice. I'll give her that. Sydney and Gale then meet up with everyone, and Sydney says that she's been through this a lot, and she doesn't resent that Billy is Sam's dad. Sydney says that running doesn't work, and when Sam snaps back, Gale says, watch your tone, new girl. Most of the Gale stuff I really like.
Well, I like that this movie, like, unlike a lot of legacy sequels, like, we just argued about Dewey, but I don't feel like this movie ever shits on Sydney.
No.
The way that people argued that people shit on Luke for Last Jedi, like... I don't think you can make that argument if you feel that way watching this movie. Because she, logical and like the rationale of, oh, she ran away. It's like, no, she ran away after the killers were killed.
Yep.
She got her happy ending, as they literally say. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's character betrayal that she's like, you know, not living in Woodsboro, because why would she? And, you know, she's married with kids. Like, but I also like that she's also not made to look stupid by coming back. She only does it because Dewey died.
Adam, feel the same?
Yeah, I do. I mean, she moved 2 movies ago. So, for people that want her to live in Woodsboro, why the hell would you?
Yeah.
You know, Laurie Strode. I mean, why would you live in that house? I do. I never thought we were going to keep referencing it, but it would have been nice to see the OG 3 together for one scene.
Yeah.
Just like Star Wars, we never get
it.
Sydney.
Well, at least you can say you got it in 4.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sid did have interaction with Dewey, you know, with the phone calls, so it's not like she didn't interact with them. So Sam wonders who she is in this scenario, the bait or the victim. She says that this isn't her story, as Richie shows up to pick them up. Sam says her leaving is the only way she can protect Tara. Sydney says that she put a tracker on her car, as that's what Gale Weathers would do.
That's what Gale Weathers should have done.
Yeah. Gale's not sure whether to take this as a compliment or not. All right. So another just baffling plot twist, or not plot twist, but plot point. Oh my God, this drove me nuts. So Tara says she needs her asthma medicine, and they need to go to Amber's house to get it. Can't you get one at a local pharmacy? Why does she need this one?
She specifically says you need a prescription.
Oh my God, which is so fucking stupid.
Which is true, but bullshit at the same time, because you do have just emergency inhalers that you get that are not the same as a prescription, but do the dilation. However, Chekhov's asthma inhaler, which is what I called it at my very first line that I wrote down on my page, I was waiting for it to come back in a bigger way. And they had to have used six different versions of what they were going to do with this inhaler. But just to get him to this party is dumb.
Richie doesn't want to go to the house because he says he actually likes having all his blood in his body, but they go there anyway. And this is where we see this is actually Stu's old house, and here's the party where everything is going to happen. And can I... Okay, so, Matt, we get a toast to Wes.
Oh, this... I think this was literally Craven.
Well, of course, but the sheriff died too. Like, it's just... It's so...
But nobody liked her.
It's so fucking stupid. It's so in your face that, okay, you want to pay tribute. We get the title card at the end. This is for Wes. That's good enough for me. But instead, they get all the voices here. We have Barrymore here. We have Matthew Litterland's voice. We have Skeet Ulrich's voice. To the fact that they're toasting to Wes. Okay. But it's just so fucking in your face. And by the way, they asked Rose McGowan to do this, and she laughed in their face.
I don't think it's in your face because it's only voiceover work. So it's literally not in your face.
It is, because he goes to Wes.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying, like, the references. It's not like Drew Barrymore, like, you physically see them. Like, I'm totally fine with this. Like, to me, this is in tone. Because you know what? There are a bunch of high school kids. They wouldn't honor a mom if, like, their friend died. Especially if she was a cop.
By making it part of the story, you're throwing plausibility out the window. I get the sentiment, but in this context, I found it to be reaching. And if I wasn't taken out in the movie by this point, this is when I was just like throwing my arms up. And it took me a couple times to finish my notes because I was just angry at this point. We're hearing that they're low on beer as Amber is sent to get some more. She closes the door and there's Mindy, who says that she failed her test. Amber says something else that you can't do is follow someone into a dark, creepy basement alone. Mindy says that she's the killer, though she's not, and her other lesson is not to trust anyone. And this shit bored me.
I need to back up about 2 minutes. One, pour me a drink, because to Wes. Yep, big fan. So, you will watch so many...
What the fuck
were
you 30 seconds ago?
Garrett moved on, because he didn't know which way I was going to go. You will watch so much in it. I don't need this scene redone so close beat for beat. This, cut this out.
I sort of like the game of chicken they're playing.
Yeah, where it's, that I like.
It's almost like who blinks first.
And I don't know if it was Matt or Adam, but somebody pointed out, and you're absolutely right. She has a creepy look to her. It's almost apparent right off the bat that she's the killer because there's just something extremely creepy about her.
That's what she... go ahead, send your emails to me. That's what she gets hired for. You know, is her face and her look. And I know it won, but I've not heard good things about Anora, and you're not going to get me to watch it. She feels like a bad 80s actress in this film. She really does. And I guess I mean that in the best way, but there's no surprises when it comes to Mikey Madison in this film.
We see Cuba's son getting some action as he passes on Liv's invitation to go upstairs as he's not sure that she's not the killer, which this was the biggest laugh for me, was this scene.
He's like, I'm 99% sure, but...
Yeah. Great.
At the same time, hey, you gotta risk it.
She takes this personal and bolts. Meanwhile, Gail says that she started all this, and Sydney said that after tonight, no more movies, no more books, no more Ghostface. Oh, if only. Mindy is watching Stab, and Chad isn't happy that she's watching a reenactment of his uncle stabbing. Chad then gets an invite to come find Liv, which he accepts. He starts walking and calling her name as the alien sound gets closer and louder, which was intentional. They wanted to give a callback to when the aliens were getting closer in that film. He turns around and there's Ghostface stabbing his leg. Chad fights him off as his finder keeps beeping. He can't get blood off this lens as his leg continues to bleed. He takes off and is then attacked again by Ghostface. He stabs him but jumps off as Richie's truck approaches.
So apparently people have a lot more than 6 quarts of blood in their body because he should be fucking dead by the time the cops get there and stop if you... This won't be the first time you hear me say that about this particular character.
You know, it's a good thing that the spinoff movies in this series are called Stab and not Kill, because there's a lot of stab and a whole lot of not dying. This is... Ghostface needs to go back to school and learn anatomy. They fucking damn people survived this just a lot.
You know what I learned about this in watching it for this is if you're stabbed 7 times, you're okay. If you're stabbed 8 times, you die. And I think that was completely intentional.
So what you're saying is he stabbed him 7 times.
Because stab 8. So Richie and Sam enter with Tara as Amber leaves to get her damn inhaler. Amber says it's time to go as Richie calms the music. And Richie says the place is a huge murder target and insists on everyone leaving. As they leave, Tara is on crutches with Amber behind her. We then see Mindy making out with Stab in the background. Mindy turns the TV back on as Richie asks for beer. He asks Mindy if she wants to come with him, and she says no, but he was smart to ask. Liv shows up angry, and Mindy asks where her brother is. She says that she's revising her suspect list as Liv says fuck this and stands up. Liv asks if she's afraid Liv's going to cut her up, and what twist will that be? She says the expert usually gets sliced in the throat before telling Mindy to enjoy her fucking movie. We didn't see Sydney and Gail. They're getting closer as they see that they're in Stu's house. And Adam, this is a shot you were talking about, right? Of them like right out in front of the house. Or was this Matt? Matt, you're the one who mentioned this. This was in the trailer.
No, yeah, the two of them. After they pull it. I like that Sydney came packing.
Yes.
Because if I was her, I would be loaded up like freaking Master Chief from Halo.
I'm telling you, I would be loaded up like Ghostface that they show earlier in this film. Like, I'd have a fucking flamethrower on me. Sydney calls Sam and tells her to get out as Mindy is yelling at the TV like Randy did in that first film.
But if you also notice, they don't call out it's the Mocker House until you physically see it.
Mm-hmm.
And they save it for Sydney when she's there. That's when you realize, oh, that's Stu's old house.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Ghostface is behind her as she turns around and he attacks. Sam hits him with a lamp as Amber and Richie walk in. In fact, everyone is here, but it's here where one of the killers is revealed. It's Amber. Amber says, welcome to Act 3, as she pulls out a gun and kills Liv.
What? No. Also, the welcome to Act 3 and then pulling out a gun. Jesus criminy. Did ChatGPT help write the script? Okay. I mean, which if she's one of them, I know the other one is one of the males. Because of size and physicality we've seen. So it narrows it down. I guess maybe that it was so obvious is the twist, but I mean, it's like going into an M. Night movie. When you anticipate a twist the whole fucking time, sometimes it's anticlimactic. And I don't care about Amber Freeman in this film, so I don't care that she's a killer.
Yeah, like I mentioned, she's in like four scenes in this entire film, and here's where she's revealed as the killer.
She's in this movie about as much as Neve Campbell, and that's not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Obvious, but I appreciate that they went with the obvious choice because they would have had to do some gymnastics to explain it if it was one of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess by default, I mean, it's not surprising, but to be perfectly honest, I appreciate that it's straightforward rather than having to do the thing of like, in two with the mom, oh, that's Mrs. Loomis. Or in the third one, yeah, it's the obvious, but then there's the familiar connection. I like this, it's, oh yeah, it's the obvious one. But to the point, we also called four. These movies, it's not necessarily about the getting it right as much as it is like the journey rather than who they choose. And considering some of these other Ghostface reveals, this one does not bother me at all.
Richie tells Sam that there's always two killers, as Sam won't put her knife down and she slithers away. Gail gets out and hears a scream, and I love her line here. That sounds about right. Amber yells that she's been stabbed, and when she sees that Sydney and Gail aren't buying it, she says, fuck it, and shoots Gail.
Oh, I love this where they're like, trap? Yep.
Yeah, she's like, but
fuck it.
Like, Sydney has a gun. They have this chick right there, and she's looking at Gail, and she's like, I'll go get her for Dewey. But Sydney doesn't fire at Amber. Oh, my God, was this fucking stupid. Oh, God.
Sydney went to the same freaking gun range that Dewey went. I mean, adjust your sights.
Yeah, I guess because they're talking about Star Wars, they all have the aim of stormtroopers.
Gail's on the ground this entire... Sydney looks at the house and enters, gun in hand. She goes from wall to wall, and she said that the killer has 5 seconds to show yourself. Sam opens a closet door and sees Tara tied up inside. She stops short of cutting her loose, though, as Sydney gets a call and is told that it's not Amber, it's the other one.
I do like that they show that Sydney, she's not careful. You got 5 seconds to show yourself whether you're the killer or not. She is shooting into closets. She's learned that lesson. As much as I wish I had more, though maybe not in this one. I always want more Neve Campbell. I think she's used well, and I think she is still a good, strong character.
Oh, boy.
And I love the way she's walking through this house.
That sets next week up very well that you want more Neve Campbell.
But yeah, the next two shows, quite frankly.
But to go with what Matt said earlier, I do agree with him on this much. I think they use Neve Campbell very well in this. In fact, when she says, I'll give you 5 seconds to show yourself, she doesn't even fucking do that. She's like, before she's opening the door, she's shooting at them. So I thought that was really good. That's how that character would be.
Yeah, and it's not like when she shows up, the movie doesn't literally put a spotlight on her. I thought they were going to do the Han and Chewie thing, like when she shows up, the movie pauses so the audience can applaud. I hate those moments in movies.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's not treated with that degree of like reverence.
Ghostface says that she hasn't seen this movie, as Sydney keeps him on the line until Richie is sitting in hiding. Ghostface appears as Sydney knocks it down. Richie gets up as Sydney crawls for the gun. Sam gets it, and Richie says, "Thank God you're okay," as he stabs Sam, finishing his sentence with, "Because I wanted to be the one who killed you." So here's the reveal. It's actually Richie and Amber as the killers.
Obvious, but again, I appreciate that they're not trying to navigate an obstacle course with these. You know, of course, for the requel logic, trying to do something different, but also being the same, having it be the boyfriend like the first one. And then Amber is basically Stu because she's much more over the top and cartoonish. This to me tracks. It doesn't bother me at all.
Somebody wanted him to be a bad guy because he was too goody two shoeing the boys, I guess. Okay, but you could have killed everybody you wanted to throughout the journey that you've had without this. Without so, I just don't get Richie's. Do you realize how many times you could have killed Sam? You didn't even have to start this film and you could have killed Sam.
But that would have ruined that would have ruined their movie, though. That would have ruined their plan.
Oh, yeah, but it would have gotten what he says was his goal. And I don't understand him and Amber getting together. So it's fine until I think about it.
Richie says that he can't believe the inhaler trick worked. That makes two of us, sir. And Sam defiantly says that this isn't a fucking movie. And Richie says that it will be because... Okay, so what happened is Richie and Amber met on Reddit message boards, and their plan was to actually make a good old stab movie again, and that this story was going to be so good, it would save the franchise. By the way, wasn't this Emmett Roberts' exact plot from the fourth film?
No, because the fourth one was all about wanting the celebrity and the jealousy of, I want the notoriety. This is what happened before sucked, and we want to, you know, bring it back to basics. And like right the wrongs of, you know, this is very much the people who said, these are the people who put out the change.org petition saying to remake episodes 7 through 9.
Oh, yeah. They are definitely yelling at Star Wars fans. They are yelling at keyboard warriors who boycott this, boycott that. I get that. And they are also yelling at, quote unquote, entitled fans, fans who say you're not a real fan unless you see blah, blah, blah. It's that mentality, which I get. Richie tells Sydney that he's a big fan, as movies laugh at them because they're a joke to them, and fandom isn't toxic. It's about love. He tells Sam that she's the villain, as Sydney liked her father and she did it to get back at the ones who killed him before. And Richie also says that it wasn't hard to fuck Sam, and their plan to get all the legacy characters involved worked. Richie says that this time it's the fans who win. So here's your logic, Adam. You're not buying it?
Hey, look, I do absolutely go with the logic that social media is a cancer that ruins people. If that's the moral of the story, sign me up.
Yeah. The phone rings as Tara shows up and attacks. Amber gets up and knocks Tara down as Amber is hit with hand sanitizer and lit on fire, just like in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I guess this is Mikey Madison's thing, getting her face lit on fire.
Oh, this made me laugh so hard with the not just letting her on fire, but even Gail's like, fuck you, basically.
We cut to Richie moving around the kitchen as Sam attacks. They fall down the stairs as Richie stands up and asks what she's going to do now. He says that the villain dies at the end as he gets her down and laughs in her face. She then says, don't fuck with the daughter of a serial killer, and stabs him no less than 15 times. He asks about his ending, and she says, here it comes, as she slices his throat and once again cleans the blade. So, Matt, do you like her going just totally apeshit like this?
Yes. And I like she does the Billy Loomis head tilt.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
The motions through the house. I get you're recreating the shot. So, okay. Yeah, I almost wish that we saw whether or not she was going crazy before. The mirror alone doesn't do it. I never felt like she was on the edge of losing it. I never felt like she was a viable suspect. So it works. I'm glad to see her a little crazy. I think they're setting her up to be a killer in the future is what this is supposed to be. But it's good. I like it. And that we kill a little differently than we've seen before, because she doesn't just stab. She stabby stab stabs.
Stabby stabs is right. Sydney says they always come back as Sam shoots him a number of times. Amber, meanwhile, once again attacks, only for Tara to shoot her down, saying that she still prefers the Babadook. We cut to ambulances being loaded as Sam is right at Tara's side. She goes to Sydney and Gail, telling them both thank you. She asks if they're going to be all right, and Sydney says they'll survive. They always do. Sam says that she was right about not running. And she asks how Gail is doing, and she responds that she's not going to write about these fuckers as they don't deserve the limelight. She's going to write about a good man who used to be sheriff here once. Sam then asks Sydney if she'll be okay, and Sid says, eventually, best line of the film, right there. Defines everything perfectly. Sam walks off, looks at Billy's reflection in the window, and goes back to Tara. She says that she's not going anywhere without her, as Sam's going to hold her hand the whole way through. Camera pans out as newscasts broadcast about the night, and we see four Wes appear on the screen, which should have been for the only time, and credits roll on Scream 2022. Matt, how did you feel about the final leg of this?
I mean, I thought the wrap-up was expected, not a whole lot of surprises, but I like that Sydney and Gail live to fight another day, and, you know, it's not a victorious ending per se, but I thought it got the job done.
I think it set up well for however they wanted to go if this movie was going to be successful, depending on how focus groups acted. Were we passing the torch or are we leaving people to continue on? So I think it served two masters that way. And if they didn't continue on with the legacy, I'm glad they gave them an ending. And if they fully passed it, then I think they set themselves up for it.
All right, that does it for a very stabby conversation about Scream 2022. Scale of 1 to 10, how do we feel about Scream 2022, Adam?
This movie changes a lot of things that we've gotten from the Scream franchise. And I don't know if all of it's for the better, but it's at least to keep you guessing. You got some good casting throughout this film. Appreciate some of the new cast. But the problem is, at the end of the day, nothing's memorable for me. None of the characters are memorable for me. I've watched her, and I can't pick Sam out of a lineup. Other than, you know, Jenna Ortega, because I've seen her in other things, and Jack Quaid, because I've seen him in some things. This cast, this motley crew that they've put together are just milquetoast bland of I don't care if they live or die. And it's a shame because they all live. This is a Scream movie where almost everybody survives other than the people who are superfluous, like side characters, not even the main characters that get brought in, but you introduce NPCs just to kill them off. And because of that, other than Dewey, you know, this might as well be a vegan restaurant because there's not many steaks to be found. Everybody still is here at the end of the day to continue on. That part is disappointing to me because I find, looking back on it, like, what do I remember? Not much of anything, but watching it, it's solid. It gives me slasher moments, but the kills are far and few between. And I think that's a product of these filmmakers getting a new franchise and knowing they wanted more than one film, but not plotting it out yet because they didn't know who they wanted to live, who they wanted to die. So many of these people live in reshoots and ADR that I think it's kind of obvious. And that takes away from me a little bit because some of these people were meant to die, but didn't. Some of these people just survived because I think they knew they were going to get a budget to make a sixth film, but it's definitely worth watching. I think Ghostface is much more aggressive and violent in the stabs, and you see some of the changes. I'm glad we got the OG3 back. I can't believe I said that, but I'm glad to see Arquette and Cox and Campbell come back to this. I think, as we said, I think David Arquette does a great job. Courtney Cox is good as Gail. I mean, she really is. I wish we had more Neve Campbell, but I think the little bit that we get is proper for the character. So it's a good film. Technically, it's one of the better ones, but it's also extremely forgettable to me, and that's kind of sad. But I'm going to be positive because I think it at least helped keep the franchise going. I'm going to give this one a 7.
Wow. After all that, you gave it a 7. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I had 6 or 7 down, and I think it's better than a 6. I think it's definitely worth seeing, but I don't know if I'll remember it in 2 weeks.
Well, this will be interesting. Is the one who has been complimenting this film going to give it higher than a 7 or a 7? Matt, go ahead.
I'm just mad he said 6-7, and I'm supposed to just act like nothing happened, but I will for the sake of the show. You know, for something that I felt was earned as far as having the opportunity to take this in a new direction, it's weird that the finished product is both more of the same, but also, for better or worse, it is a Scream movie. This doesn't feel out of place in the grand scheme of the franchise. And all in all, I had a darn good time with this, in particular with the angle they took of going after both the horror genre and its perception in the eyes of fandom. and the toxicity that has happened, which you could argue is as important with the negative and positive connotations as elevated horror. I think the statement, it's a lot angrier in the way that I think it echoes Ghostface being much more of a blunt instrument rather than a killer that has antics that are as theatrical as the outfit. You know, I like that this one's a little bit more relentless and brutal. And like I said, for something where I didn't want the legacy characters returning, I thought the performances that the three of them gave were more than commendable and exceeded my expectations, because I don't think any of the three are great actors necessarily. But I was happy to see them back, and I was happy to be proven wrong. As far as the returning, the new cast, I liked the Carpenter sisters a lot, and I thought their inclusion as far as taking the reins for the future, whether we knew we'd get another movie or not, I felt like they earned the ability to do so. And the supporting cast, I think, does an amicable job. I enjoy seeing them. There's no one in here that I absolutely detest, which I could say about almost all of the previous movies. There's at least one character I don't find myself endearing to at all. I just wish the movie, to your guys' point, not that it was longer or shorter, I just wish there was a little bit more focus. And maybe that's because of COVID and how movies had to be shot, that you're willing to forgive certain leaps in logic or characters being in the same place because of actor locales and the stuff that we had to navigate during that time. Not to excuse it, but that is something to keep in mind as well. You know, I don't like to be Mr. Hot Take, because I reserve that for Garrett, because he tends to be, you know, the guy people get mad at. I'm going to get hate for this. This is the best of the series, in my opinion. I'm giving this an 8.
Oh, damn near spill my drink. All right, an 8 from Matt Goudreau. This scared me, because out of the ones we are going to be seeing, at least the next one, I heard this was the best. After hearing that and going in, I had lofty expectations. I guess this is a result of lofty expectations, because this movie let me down in a lot of ways. I get the sentiment of paying tribute to a director who, by all intents and purposes, influenced a lot of the filmmaking going on today. But the problem with Scream as a franchise now is, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, what do? You can't go back to the slasher genre, because nobody cares about those characters anymore. We are getting a Friday the 13th TV series, but how much traction have we heard from that? You know, so I was happy with what they did with Dewey and Gale in this film. A big problem I have, and a thing I think could fix up a lot of the plot holes, is I mentioned that the mom is given lip service and then dropped. The way you fix that is you have the mom be the killer, and then you have the dad being dead the entire time. I think that would fix a lot of the problems I have with this movie. I think as a whole, I don't mind Melissa Barrera, although, as I mentioned, I never thought that there was any way she could be the killer, mostly because I know she's in the next one. Jenna Ortega, I love seeing actresses and actors in roles that we know in the future they're going to be stars. And this was the making of a star, because later on that same year, she would really explode with Wednesday and have a pretty notable career that's still going strong today. I think on a technical level, this movie is very good. I think this is the best made out of the five that we've seen so far. But I had a real problem with a lot of the handlings of the plots and the fact that we have a Scream movie and we have hardly any kills. That drove me crazy, which is a lot of the things that drove me crazy about this film, which I've already mentioned. So I'm going straight down the middle. I'm giving this a 5. I think it was good to see everybody back. We have a lot of legacy characters. We have a lot of people who have been hatched from legacy. You know, we didn't mention this, but almost everybody here, we have Cuba Gooding's son. We have Dennis Quaid's son. We mentioned in Scream 4, we had Eric Roberts' daughter and Julia Roberts' niece be the killer in that. I think they really had something with that. And I don't like the killer reveals here. I don't like this movie as a whole. But a 5, I was entertained enough. And after what the first Scream did, as far as establishing the A to B's as to how the killers worked, I didn't get that here. I felt like I was looking at a whiteboard with a dart being thrown, and this is what they landed on. So 5 on 10 for Scream. Next week, we have Scream 6. Or is it Scream the One? I don't know. I'm looking at the title right now, and it's weird the way these letters are handled. But next week, I gotta be honest, all I know about next week is it takes place in New York. And the last time a horror franchise went to New York, well, Jason took Manhattan. Matt, what are you expecting when we talk Scream 6 next week?
I'm expecting fights, just given how this show went. But yeah, New York going to the big city. I thought that was interesting, though, for Scream, because it's so predominantly like a West Coast horror franchise. Yeah. To go the complete opposite, I thought was an interesting choice. But I also, looking at it, said that's a lot of opportunity to do, you know, something larger in scope. And for a character with Ghostface, where it's the different killer every time, doing that in the most populated city in America, where, you know, anonymity is impossible in New York, or so you think, gave me some hope for doing that beyond just a gimmick.
Adam, we have the same writing team. We have the same directing team returning. How do you feel about Scream 6 next week?
I think this is the one where they decide they're going to make their own Scream movie and not a continuation. I vaguely remember anything about it other than the problems with Neve Campbell, which I'm sure we'll discuss. I remember my thought and my words when I saw a teaser probably before a movie was Ghostface Takes Manhattan. So thank you for stealing that joke before I got to it. And I remember being pissed that the trailer showed Ghostface using a shotgun. And that's it. I haven't seen it. And I guess it was either, look, their choices were Ghostface Goes Manhattan or Ghostface Goes to Space. So at least we're still on Earth. We'll see what happens by the end of this franchise. But I think this is, look, they're not encumbered anymore. They set themselves up for the road. We'll see if the plane flies.
Hey, will next week warrant another slasher style fight? We'll see. But until next week, when we get to Scream 6.
It's your favorite scary movie.
I prefer animated films and podcasts. Thank you, boys.
The past will come back to bite you in the ass. Whatever you think you know about the past, forget it. The past is not at rest. Any sins you think were committed in the past are about to break out and destroy you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Wow. That was intense.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun.
But us, we're going to carry on and plan the sequel, because let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Megan films, and so much more.
The reason I'm here is to help you.
Scream retrospective introduction performed by Adam and Sarai, directed by Garrett. Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
It could be fucking Reservoir Dogs by the time this thing is through.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
By definition alone, they're inferior films.
It's bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
Yeah.
Aliens. Far better than the first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Thank you, Ridley Scott rules.
Scheduling done by Matt.
What did you just say?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
This is all because of you.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
So how can I help you? Or do you want me to tell you who you look like?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Now welcome to the final act.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Sid, don't you blame the movies! Movies don't create psychos! Movies make psychos more creative!
So in closing, let me say, good luck, Godspeed, and for some of you, I'll see you soon.
And they started putting this together with their third guy by the name of Guy Buzik. Buzik, right? Buzik, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know how you say it, okay. But it's B-U-S-I-C-K. Yeah.
Guy Buzik. And you can't do remakes like Flatliners, Black Christmas, and Child's Play 2019. You have to do something new. New main characters are supported by and related to legacy characters.
There's a problem. Child's Play did do something different.
I know. Yeah.
That's why
Black Christmas.
Yeah.
Oh. Boy, two bad remakes of that film.
They fucked that up twice.
And that's what should have been brought up. But this is an offensive level of product placement. This thing paid for itself completely in freaking ads of Mountain Dew and Pizza Hut and Doritos here on out. This is a comedy level of product ads.
My favorite part of having Adam on this podcast is the hills that he dies on. They are so great.
I also would never go to bat for Pizza Hut. The pizza never looks that good.
Oh, it fucking tastes like the cardboard it comes in.
No, it tastes like somebody came in a cardboard box.
Pineapple on pizza.
Now I'm not ever going to eat white sauce pizza again. Sam leaves. This fucking enraged me. I hated this so much. I have zero feeling toward this death. Matt?
Go to Adam first.
Okay, Adam, go.
This made me mad.
Sid did have interaction with Dewey, you know, with the phone calls, so it's not like she didn't interact with him. So I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's not like when Cindy, when she got off the plane, went to hug Sam and left Gale alone, like in Force Awakens when just fucking walk right by Chewie.
That's how they grieve. Didn't you know that? Oh, we talked
Sydney
about that.
Sydney doesn't hand a medal after Dewey dies.
All right.
Oh, by the way, Dewey left you these dice in his trailer.
All right, so Palpatine's her grandfather. Sam wonders who But they go there anyway, and this is where we see that this is actually Randy's old house, which...
No, it's Stu's house.
Oh, I'm sorry, Stu's old house. Yeah, you're right. This is where we see this is actually Stu's old house, and... We then see Mindy making out with Stab in the background, which, I don't know, just this callback to the Randy scene from that first one. Would somebody be there to be able to reenact this? I don't know, but I guess... Adam, did you notice, like, how would they know that this is what happened? Adam, did you catch that or no?
I'm still here.
Okay, you're still there. Where's Adam? Oh, there you are.
He was on mute.
Okay.
Sorry, I missed that.
Okay, never mind. It didn't matter anyway.
And then Amber is basically Stu because she's much more over the top and cartoonish. This, to me, tracks. It doesn't bother me at all.
Adam?
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Lisa Simpson.
Somebody wanted him to be a bad guy because...
Scale of 1 to 10, how do we feel about Scream 2022, Adam?
This movie changes a lot of things that we've gotten from the scrap, from the stat, from the Scream franchise.
Where, you know, anonymity is impossible in New York, or so you think, gave me some hope for doing that beyond just a gimmick.
All right, Matt, we have the same team. Directing team, writing team, returning next week. What are you expecting with Scream 6?
I assume Adam. You mean Adam.
I'm sorry. Adam, we have the same writing team. We have the same directing team returning.
All right, that's enough. That'll be a wrap. The sequel discussion to be continued.